Well, this Psalm 28 has a lot to say about prayer and our relationship with God, the expectations we have of God. Have you ever had to suffer consequences with a group of people because some of them had done something wrong and so the whole group got into trouble for it? Even though you yourself had not been involved in that wrongdoing. I remember one time in his first or second grade, my teacher whisking me out of the classroom, spanking me because I was talking during class. She had heard talking from the corner I was sitting in, but it wasn't me. Must have been other people sitting around me, but she didn't believe that, so I got spanked anyway. How do you deal with a situation like that? When God sent the nation of Israel into exile, there were faithful Jews, men like Daniel, girls like Esther, who suffered. Maybe Esther was born later on in Babylon, but they suffered plunder of their possessions. They suffered capture and exile, along with their apostate nation, even though they personally were innocent of rebellion against God. How do you deal with that in relating to God? The same can happen to us today. Just as God deals with nations and communities and families as corporate bodies, as well as with individuals for our own individual sake, there are going to be times that we experience hardships that are really the fault of our community or our family. How do you pray in that context? Psalm 28 gives us some ideas of how to relate to God in the midst of this. It opens with David laying before God two prohibitives and two imperatives, four commands, two of them negative, two of them positive, alternating back and forth. Don't just sit there and do nothing, he tells God. Positively, give heed to my plea. And he's going to build a case, a logical and judicial case as he prays. Don't punish me along with the wicked. Instead, give the bad guys the punishment they deserve. Four commands that David starts off with telling God. And then, as is often the structure of Hebrew poetry, the middle of the psalm is the main point. We call that a chiasm because it's like the Greek chi or the English letter X. It points into the middle, and that's the main point. What's the main point? God heard my prayer. And then David circles back to the end. The chiasm goes back out to four more commands. Since God heard, I'm going to pray for four more things. And he gives four more imperatives. Save my people, bless my people, provide for my people, and carry them. Now, all these things were things that David, as a king, was responsible for the nation of Israel to do. As a king, well, even before that, as a shepherd, he was responsible for saving, preserving the lives of his sheep, blessing them, providing for them, shepherding, and carrying them when they needed help. And then as a king, he was responsible to do for the nation of Israel, domestic defense, keeping them safe from foreign invasions, leading the army, praying for God to bless the nation, providing for the general welfare, organizing a wise economy, generally keeping the nation encouraged and moving along. These are the roles of a leader, and David prays for God to do this for his nation. David sees God as the true power behind his throne in verse 8. and ask God to take responsibility for these things for his nation in a way that he, as a mortal man, could never fully control. What is the exact setting of this psalm? All we know is that David wrote it, most probably. The superscriptions were added sometime after the actual writing of these psalms, but they're probably accurate. John Calvin commented, "After being delivered by God's help from great dangers, David, in this psalm, according to his custom, first records the vows that he had made in the midst of his difficulties, and then his thanksgivings and praises to God to induce others to follow his example." It's probable that he speaks of his persecutions by Saul. And there are other guesses. Maybe this was instead later on in his reign, when different sons of his challenged his kingship, tried to usurp him. But we don't know for sure. David sets an example for us here. When he's under stress, the first words in this psalm, where are they in here? The first words in the psalm are, "It is to you, Lord, my rock, that I call." That's where he goes. When he hits that stress, the first thing he goes to, the first person he goes to, is to the Lord. And he sets the example for us there. When we are under stress, it needs to be God and God alone that we go to in prayer first. Now there is as with most of the Psalms, there is another level of fulfillment to the Psalms, and that is the Messiah's fulfillment. And in so many of these Psalms, you can take David out and place Jesus in, and it works. And I believe it's intentional. The Bible does call David a prophet. As with many, the church father, Augustine, wrote in his commentary on the Psalms some 1700 years ago that this prefigures Christ in his role as mediator. Christ is the mediator between God and man. Here's a picture of prayer going on by a mediator for his people. Augustine talked about Jesus stretching his hands out on the cross and praying not only, my God, why have you forgotten me, which is kind of similar to some of these ideas going on in Psalm 28, but also forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing, caring for his people. Jesus trusted God and found strength, was resurrected and became the salvation of his people, the anointed one, and now intercedes for us before God, praying, save them, bless them, provide for them, my church, lift them up in this age and forever in the age to come. So there is in this psalm a picture for us of what Jesus is doing even now for us. But stepping into the specific requests in verse 1, David gives his first command and gives a reason for it. Don't be silent in regards to me. The reason is, if you sit still in regard to me, then I'm going to be in the same boat with those who go down to the pit. He's arguing a case. Gives a reason for every point he makes. And he uses vivid word pictures, too, to bring each point across. Not unlike an attorney would in making a case before a court. And note the reason that he gives. Again, this is a model for us in prayer. When we talk to God, we can make a case. We can give the reasons why we're asking God to do things. It is a great way of providing accountability to ourselves. Can I make a biblical case for this request? Can I make a case that is going to be consistent with God's character? If so, I can be pretty confident that God's going to answer that prayer positively. Note how David reasons. He's not reasoning in terms of do this because I need it. Do this because I deserve it. Do this because, I don't know. What he instead argues using God's interests. God, you're just, right? This doesn't look just. Are you going to do something about this, God? Is it just for me to meet the same punishment as the wicked does? Your justice is on the line here, God, and I believe that I can call you to act because you are just, and this is consistent with your character. It's going to be inconsistent with your character if you sit there and do nothing. God, is it appropriate for you to ignore someone who's reaching out to you? We know that you are merciful, that you respond, that when the weak and the poor cry out to you, that you help. If you don't do this, this would not be your character. You have made a covenant relationship with me. For you to abandon that covenant relationship and forget me and leave me to the wolves here would be inconsistent with your own commitments, Lord. You don't want to lose that relationship with me because you've pursued that relationship with me. Now make good on that. He's arguing in terms of God's interest and God's perspective on this stress that he's under. In Isaiah 38, it talks about those who go down to the pit being the same thing as death. It's not Sheol that thanks you or death that praises you. Those who go down to the pit do not hope in your truth. Dead. He's talking about, I'm going to be dead if you don't act, Lord. And indeed, it is the case for us. We will be dead if God does not act to save us. Revelation chapter 20 speaks of a bottomless pit and a lake of fire and says, anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. We ourselves need God to act, or we're going to be in the same boat with those who go down to the pit, who go down to the lake of fire. Verse 2, he says, give heed to the voice of my supplication. And then he gives a reason, I think. He says, because it's right now, while I am crying out to you, I'm raising my hand in the direction of the oracle of your holiness. I am reaching out to you, and so you need to give heed to the voice of my supplication. 1 Kings 6 clearly identifies this Dabir, this oracle or speech place, as the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle. It's the place where Moses heard the voice of the Lord speaking out to him. And we find David must have taught his son the same idea, because later on we find Solomon praying in 1 Kings 8. At the dedication of the temple, he says, whatever prayer, whatever supplication is made by anyone or by all your people Israel, then each one knows the plague of his heart and spreads out his hands towards this temple, then hear in heaven your dwelling place and forgive and act and give to everyone according to all his ways. You hear the echoes of Psalm 28. In Solomon, his son's prayer. He's reaching out to God and to the place of where God has localized his special presence at the mercy seat on the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy place. That's where God's special presence was. And so, you know, it's just part of this whole paradigm of I'm praying to you, God, and to no one else. I'm first going to you in this time of stress. Verse 3, you must not put me in tow with evil men or with those who commit iniquity while saying peace with their neighbors despite evil intentions in their heart. Again, a reason. These are bad guys. They're hypocrites. They're saying peace, but their hearts are full of evil. You must not lump me together with such people. You can't let me suffer the same punishment that they deserve. It looks like I'm going to get the same thing that they're getting. God, would you act? The Hebrew word for to drag or draw or tow is generally used in the Bible to describe the action of tying a rope onto somebody and pulling them along. And the wording here in this psalm, it's unclear whether it's describing the evil men lassoing David and pulling him down, or whether this is God rounding up the bad guys and dragging them off to prison, as it were. But the point is, it's not right for David and the bad guys to be hanging on the same rope. David shouldn't be lumped together with them or left under their jurisdiction because they're evil. They're faking like everything's fine while they carry out evil and malice and mischief. We see in the New Testament, Jesus clearly got upset at hypocrisy like that. Puritan commentator Matthew Henry saw in this verse a model for prayer. Save me from being infected with their sins and from doing as they do. Let me not be drawn away by their fallacious arguments or their allurements from the holy oracle where I desire to dwell all the days of my life to practice their wicked works. Dear Lord, and that's consistent with the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And then the fourth petition here. Give to them what matches their deeds, what matches the evil of their accomplishments. Give to them what matches the works of their hands. Deal their payback to them. And he gives another reason. Each imperative comes with his reason. Because they are not perceptive to the works of the Lord or to the doings of his hands. It fits with justice for the shoe to drop on those who ignore God. And so punish them, not me. And he's not doing that vindictively. He's appealing to justice. He's appealing to God's justice. He's not appealing to revenge here. There's not a note of revenge in this psalm. And that's always going to be a hard balance. When you're under that stress, natural tendency is going to be, I want vengeance on these people that were mean to me. But if you can separate that and say, God, I believe you're just. Let your will be done. I know justice is your will. It is okay to pray along these kind of lines. Of course, we realize that we, because of our own sins against God, also deserve to be in that same boat. And it is only God's mercy that delivers us from that kind of the same punishment that is coming to the rest of the world. It's only God's mercy that preserves us, that's going to save us from that lake of fire, that's going to write our name in that book of life. It's only God's mercy, but we ask for it. It's proper and right, and God gives us this example. It is right to ask for that. Punish them, but not me, Lord. I am trusting in you to save me. In the middle of the verse, then, we get the answer. The four petitions are followed by a summary of God's answer and of what's true in this situation. In verse 5, he says, he will demolish them and he will not build them up. The Lord is blessed because he has given heed to the voice of my supplication. The Lord is my strength and my shield. It is in him that my heart has trusted, so I will be helped out, and my heart will rejoice, and through my song I will respond to him. Yahweh is the strength of his people, and he is the source of strength behind the salvations of his anointed one. Verse 7 speaks of strength and a shield. The strength is offensive. That's the killing the bad guys. The shield is the defensive, protecting from getting hurt by the bad guys. It's possible that the first word for strength is speaking more also of a defensive position. It's possible it's speaking of a refuge, a stronghold, as it were. God brings me to safety in a stronghold when I cry out for help, and then he keeps me safe there. That's another possible interpretation that is also accurate to what we know of God. David, it seems that he has written this psalm after the answer to his prayer. Again, the historical context is not really in this psalm. We don't know exactly what's going on, exactly when it was written. But he has these three things that either have already happened. You can construe the imperfect verb along with the perfect. My heart has trusted. That's a past tense. And so therefore the three verbs that follow, I'm helped, my heart will rejoice, I will sing, could come after that past tense, I trusted. Or since they are imperfect, they could be futures. I will be helped. I will rejoice. I will sing. And the psalm doesn't clearly tell us which way it is, whether this is faith that this is going to happen or a testimony that this has happened. In truth, isn't it true that every time, no matter how many triumphs and answers to prayer, the next time you hit stress, you're questioning again. You still need that faith for trusting. Yes, okay, I am going to trust now, and it will be true that I will be helped. I will be rejoicing in the future. I will be singing to God about this, even though I don't feel like singing right now. I'm going to trust. So whether this particular verse is past or future doesn't necessarily affect our application of this. We always need to look forward to that future hope. And all of us who've had experiences with God can look back in the past to those times when, yes, God has done some amazing things to take care of me and provide for me and save me even when I cried out for help. In the Old Testament system of worship, it was standard for when God had done something special in your life to bring a special sacrifice to the temple. And an expert in the Old Testament, one of the commentaries I read, said that the sacrifice of thanksgiving was often accompanied by a public recitation of a psalm of thanksgiving. So that may be the context. David is going to sing a song in the temple praising God. Maybe this very one, Psalm 28, was sung there. We also see King Hezekiah doing that. Towards the end of his reign, when God healed him, he said, I'm going to make up a song and sing it to the Lord. That was part of the thanksgiving process. And I know we've had people in our church that have written songs, that even one we sang today. That's a very appropriate expression of our thankfulness to God. If that's where your gifting is, and not everybody has to do that exact way of thanking God, but we all, what are the ways that you thank God, and how are you going to thank him when that deliverance comes after you've cried out for his help? John Calvin said, when God spreads cheerfulness through our hearts, it is to open our mouths to sing his praises. Verse 8 has an interesting textual variant. The King James and the New American Standard follow the reading of the Masoretic Hebrew text, which dates to about 1000 A.D. The Lord is their strength, Whereas the ESV and the NIV follow the reading of the 2nd century B.C. Septuagint and the Syriac, too, which read, the Lord is the strength of his people. And in Hebrew, the difference between those two readings is just one letter. So it's understandable that there might be two different, they're that close in Hebrew, even though they don't look that close in English. Either way, it is saying the same thing. God being the strength of his people, that is put in parallel, verse 8, with God being the strength of the people's anointed king. The words in the second half of the verse can be translated in terms of offensive military action or defensive action. It's ambiguous. So some translations go for the defensive meanings. It's a stronghold, safety. His salvation is a stronghold. It's a safe place. Others go for the offensive meanings. It's a victory. It's might that God is providing for his people, and both are true. John Calvin commented on the fact that the word salvation or saving is plural in Hebrew. David employs salvations or deliverances in the plural number because he's often been preserved in various ways. The meaning, therefore, is that from the time when God had anointed him by the hand of Samuel, he never ceased to help him, but delivered him in innumerable ways until he had accomplished the work of his grace in him. And isn't that true for us as well? We have a lifetime to look back on many ways in which God has helped us, delivered us, responded to our prayers. Classic commentator William Plumer wrote, every believer has abundant cause for blessing and praising God when he thinks of all God has been and ever shall be to him, of all that God has done, is doing, and ever shall be doing for him, of the ills he's escaped, for the good things he's authorized to hope for. How can his praises of the Almighty be considered excessive? This confidence that God has heard these four requests and answered and will answer inspires the psalmist to expand his prayers beyond himself towards his people. In verse 9, cause your people to be safe and bless your inheritance and provide for them and carry them into eternity. It's important to note that in Hebrew, the word people is not the plural of the word person, like it is in English. The word people is a word that's designating a people group, a nation, an ethnic group. And when you realize this, David is praying for the salvation of a nation. He's not just hoping that certain individuals are going to get saved. Certainly we want that. But his prayer has a much bigger scope in mind. It's a nation. We see this same word, people, which meaning nation, not individual. We see this throughout the New Testament. And I just wanted to take a minute to show you some of this strand here. When God spoke to Mary, the mother of Jesus, he said, she will bring forth a son. You will call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. there's a body, a nation that he's going to save. Matthew 2:6, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, not the least, out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. And as we see in the Old Testament, when we look at the people of God, we're not talking about a collection of individuals who happen to trust God. We're talking about a nation, the nation of Israel, that God called to be his people. The Messiah is promised to rule, to shepherd that people, but it goes beyond the promises go beyond that. Luke 1:17 quotes from Malachi, turn the hearts of the fathers of the children, disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. To make ready a people. Luke 1, Zechariah's prayer, verse 68. Blessed is the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people. Not just his individual souls, not just a bank of mercy that random people might draw from. It's a people that he has redeemed. Acts 15, Simon, also better known as Peter, has declared how God at first visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. The Gentiles, a people for his name. Now this is the new development in the New Testament, is that the people is widened from the political nation of Israel to include Gentiles. And and actually to exclude the political nation of Israel. Acts 26, Paul is speaking to the Jews in Rome. The prophecies that Christ, the Messiah, would suffer. He'd be the first to rise from the dead and would proclaim light to the people and to the Gentiles. Here's that Old Testament understanding. He's going to proclaim it to the people, obviously, the Jews, and to the Gentiles. Romans 9:25, Hosea, I will call them my people who are not my people, and beloved who is not beloved, who were not God's people who became his people. These are the Gentiles. Titus 2:14, Christ gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed, purify for himself his own special people, a people group, zealous for good works. These were Gentiles in Crete that he's talking to there in Titus. And Hebrews, therefore, where are we? Hebrews 2. Therefore, in all things Christ had to be made like his brethren, the Jews, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in all things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Again, the people. Hebrews 8. This is the covenant, quoting Jeremiah 31. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. God made a covenant with a house, not just with an individual. I will put my laws in their mind, write them on their hearts, and I will be their God. They'll be my people. And there's, again, the people, speaking of the New Testament people. 1 Peter 2, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. These are people in Turkey, modern-day Turkey, Gentiles, scattered throughout the kind of the northern regions of Turkey. You are a chosen generation, royal priesthood, holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but now are the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. And we see in the book of Revelation, God redeeming with his blood out of every tribe and language and people and nation. The word people there, speaking of different ethnic groups, all the different Gentile ethnic groups, as well as the Jewish ethnic group. And in Revelation 18 and 21, again, those who are saved, those who trust God, are considered a body as though they were a nation. These people from every tongue and tribe and nation are a body. They constitute a body. We would call that the church. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins. God's people, the church, doesn't participate in the world system of Babylon. Revelation 21, the tabernacle of God is with men. He will dwell with them. They will be his people. God will be with them and be their God. There's a corporate nature to our relationship with God. The New Testament also talks about Jesus inheriting this nation, this nation of holy people. Ephesians 1, in whom you, having heard the word of the truth, the good news of your salvation, in whom you also, having believed, were sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise, who is a down payment of the inheritance to us unto redemption of his possession into the praise of his glory. The inheritance of us, what's being inherited? We are going to be inherited. Who's going to inherit us? Jesus will inherit us. Redemption of his possession. Who is his possession? We are his possession. And he's going to get us when he returns and we enter fully into that relationship where he is our king, our God, and we are his people and we live together. That's spoken of as him inheriting us. It's an amazing thought. And later on in verse 18, Ephesians 1:18, it brings this thing is what the wealth of the glory of his inheritance in the saints. He's inheriting saints, and it's going to be glorious. The third prayer for this people that David as king prays for is that God would shepherd them or provide for them. The root meaning roya in Hebrew has to do with giving fodder to sheep, and extends figuratively into leadership. This is ultimately what Jesus is going to do. We see in the book of Revelation, chapter 7, 15. They are before the throne of God, and they serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them, and they shall neither hunger nor thirst anymore. He's providing food, or at least they're satisfied somehow. The sun will not strike them, nor any heat, for the Lamb who's in the midst of the throne will shepherd them. The Lamb now, in this ironic turn about, is the shepherd now. He will shepherd them. And that role of shepherding is not just God's Old Testament relationship with his people, like we sang in Psalm 23. This is what we have, what we look forward to in the new heavens and new earth. Forever, our relationship with God, it will continue to be. He will be like a shepherd, providing and leading them to living fountains of waters and wiping away every tear from their eyes. That's glorious. And then the last verb, the last request, carry them, lift them up. A key place we see that same word is in Exodus 19. Where God reminds the Jews, the Hebrews, that he's delivered out of Egypt. He says, look back and remember. You've seen what I did to the Egyptians. You've seen how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the requests that David extends, and they are typical of what our Lord Jesus is indeed going to do. And so it's perfectly consistent for us to pray for Jesus to do these same things for us now. We know it's his will. I want to maybe pull out three final points here to before I close off. There's a tension between living in a community that's going to experience corporate punishment or blessing when only a certain percentage of the group has actually been evil or righteous. David prays for God's blessing on his community as a whole for his personal sake as a faithful man, while at the same time asking God to make some distinction in his community and not judge him along with the wrongdoers in his community. There's a tension in that. And we can reflect that in our own prayers. I don't want to get punished, but I do want justice. Later on in Israel's history, during the exile, Gerald Wilson in his commentary said, you know, think about that same situation, the Jews in exile. They had that same tension. Well, we're under judgment, but I don't want to be judged. How do you deal with that? He noted, you know, those people could have wallowed in self-pity, refusing to accept any solidarity with their suffering community. I didn't deserve this. I shouldn't have been punished with them. They could have demanded divine explanation for what was essentially an unjust act. God, why didn't you? You are unjust. But that wouldn't, that's not a godly attitude. That's not the way that the psalmist teaches us to pray in a situation like that. Whenever we love instead of hate, whenever we exchange self-protection for risky compassion, save them. Bless your inheritance. When we allow our hearts to be broken by the suffering of the world around us, we turn our own senseless suffering not into a cry of anger, but into a plea for unity and restoration, just as David did in Psalm 28. Shepherd them and carry them. Can you do that when you are under the stress that you don't think is your fault? Can you turn that instead of a cry of anger, God, why did you do that? To please deliver me. Please bring justice in an appropriate way, but please bless your people. Who knows, but we may find ourselves damaged by an economic crash or a foreign invasion or persecution. Will we be able to pray like David prayed in stresses like these? David's testimony in this psalm is that God answers prayer. So take heart. God answers prayer. Commentary I read I like the wording here. The wailings of penitence shall be succeeded by the sweet consciousness of forgiving mercy. You will be forgiven when you confess your sins. The sorrowing of affliction shall usher in a long day of joy and prosperity. The cry of oppressed innocence shall bring down upon some guilty head the ministers of divine wrath. We can trust God will bring justice. God will bring deliverance for his people. He will answer prayer. He does answer prayer. Take heart and pray. And one last quote from one more commentator, Matthew Henry. Those that pray in faith may rejoice in hope. He has heard me. He has graciously accepted me. And I am sure of a real answer as if I had it already. What we win by prayer, we must wear by praise. Has God heard our supplications? Then let us bless his name.